Welcome to AP Psych!
Okay, and we're back for part two.
Part two. Which is exciting because we get to start with Ash and Milgram's experiments. Milgram's obedience study and Ash's conformity experiment. We really dove into both of these in the Nearpod, so I'd highly recommend going back to review those. The questions will help you also to review what happened in those studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to talk about them? Or
sure.
Well,
we don't have...
Do you want to talk about them? I don't care. No, I was just going to go to this if you wanted to summarize.
That's beautiful.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
You didn't say thank you.
I'm thank sorry. You.
I just like automatically thought that you were going to say thank you. So I said, you're welcome. I didn't mean like you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean like
oh boy. Well, very delayed, thank you.
I didn't mean like you should say thank you. I just like I already thought that you were gonna say it, so I just said you're welcome and then you didn't say it's okay.
Okay.
Milgram's obedience experiment is excuse me. Milgram's obedience experiment is the shocking experiment, like literal shock, not like, oh, that's surprising. I mean, like shocking, right? Yeah, like, so people were asked to shock somebody, and they were under like somebody who was over their authority said like, okay, you're going to shock this person with this voltage. The person who was being shocked was not being shocked, right?
Right,
right. I was going to say, I'm pretty sure I knew that.
They were in a separate room.
Yeah, they were in a different room. And so they were an actor acting as if they were being shocked. And so basically what the experiment was trying to see is how many people would actually conform and obey this person who was over their authority. They found that 65% of the people continued to shock the person all the way to 450 volts.
Yes, that's... which was marked on the machine as just XXX.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Just a little sign. But the conclusion was that we tend to obey an authority figure, basically, right? The terms that you definitely want to know for this are diffusion of responsibility, de-individuation, right? And then obedience. So those are the things that you want to know for that. Did I miss anything important? Okay.
Awesome. I don't think so. Then the other experiment that we talked about in that Nearpod was Ash's conformity experiment. This was looking at how do we conform to the group, even when the information is obviously wrong. So he used the lines that there was a test line and it would say, you would get see three other ones and it would say like which one's closest to that size or to the test line. But this was not like our perception and sensation where they were trying to play mind tricks. This was like if you asked a group what color is the sky and 30 people said red. There was a clearly wrong answer. So even if you know the information is wrong, would you conform? And under what conditions are we more likely or less likely to do so? The results found that people agreed with the group's wrong answer at least once in 75% of the trials. And in all trials, subjects agreed with the group's wrong answer about a third of the time. So they concluded from this that more people who give conforming answer is the more likely people are to give that answer, even if it's wrong. So if only two people give the wrong answer, you're less likely to conform than if 50 people gave the wrong answer. Oh, this is actually my favorite part, that people would attribute their wrong answer to themselves, like to poor eyesight. So when asked like, hey, this is actually the right answer, why'd you get that wrong? They'd say like, oh, like I have poor eyesight, instead of saying, well, everyone else said number two, so I wanted to say number two. They usually didn't contribute the wrong answer to wanting to conform.
That, children, is called a sellout. But that is not a term that you need to know.
No, the terms you need to know are normal social influence, groupthink, and group polarization.
Exactly. Nice little summary there. Thank you. All right, so let's move on to social influence. The chameleon effect. This video really freaked me out, the one with friends. If you are a sitcom aficionado, like most of us are, and you know that canned laughter is kind of like, it's weird if you don't, like, you never really think about not having it, and like sometimes it doesn't even feel, it's just like a part of the show.
Yeah.
So to watch this without the laughter, the awkward silences,
so weird,
eat away at me. I can't stand it.
Yep.
And then you're like, I'm not gonna laugh, because if nobody else is laughing, then you're probably not gonna laugh either. Yeah. You know, so I think with Ash's experiment and with the chameleon effect, I feel like confidence is key. Like, if you know that something is funny, laugh at it. It's okay. But the
You can be the only student to laugh at our jokes. It is okay.
We appreciate any and all laughter. Even like little smirks are fine. Yeah. Like, it's okay. that's a good one. But the Tanya... Do you know...
What? Chartrand.
Chartrand. Okay. I don't know what I was
confidence.
I'm sorry. So, and John Barg, right?
Sure.
Okay. They're the ones who are attributed to this chameleon effect. We don't really talk about them outside of this, so they're not like huge players. But you can also think of the chameleon effect as like when one person yawns, everybody else yawns, right?
And if you don't, you're a sociopath.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not an official diagnosis. We'll start doing that next.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can't officially diagnose.
Yeah, no, we're actually not doing
that. We're going to stop there. I think Oprah is the best person who like shows with her. It's not really a chameleon effect. It's more of like a mimicking kind of thing. Like, she does it intentionally. But if you ever watch an Oprah interview, like whenever the person that she's interviewing leans in on their right elbow, she'll like in her conversation lean on her right elbow. Again, not the chameleon effect, just more mimicking, but similar to the chameleon effect. If that's something else that you want to think about.
So we talked about conformity, changing our behavior, thinking, actions, etc., to be like the group. Conformity really increases when one is made to feel incompetent or insecure. The group is larger than three people. The group is unanimous, so everyone else agrees and you don't. Or others in the group are observing others' behavior. So you can see the answer that other people are giving. You're being evaluated or judged for the answers that you give or the behaviors that you have.
Mm-hmm. And there's two different reasons for conformity. There's normative social influences and informational social influences. So normative social influences is changing behavior and attitude and your thinking. So like peer pressure, right? And then informational social influences is when we don't know how to be we don't know how to do, right?
Yeah.
And so we copy other people. An example of normative social influences is going to be like the extra baggy jeans that you all wear. That's trendy, right? Going back to like the, if we go back to, I mean, I know that the early 2000s, Y2K, that's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back to wearing the dress over the jeans, absolutely, I might not lose it, honestly. Yeah. Like, Ashley Tisdale doesn't even want to go back to that. Like,
even the dress over the leggings was a choice. A little better.
Better than the jeans.
And then the belt over the dress.
The wide belt is unnecessary. You can ask Kim Kardashian. Like, she will agree with you. Whereas informational social influences is going to be more like, if you've ever watched, I'm going to give two movie examples just in case we haven't seen the one. Okay. The one is random, so get ready for it.
I'm ready.
If you've ever seen the Titanic...
Is this the random
one? No, that's not the random one. Or Shrek 2. Okay. So in both of those movies, either Jack or Shrek are...
you know, are comparable characters.
Okay, but get ready for it. So they are both in situations where they have never been in before. Jack being like a basically stowaway on the ship, he finds himself in first class dining and he has like 2,000 forks in front of him. Shrek, same thing. He goes to far, far away and they go to eat with Fiona's parents and he has like 1,000 different spoons that aren't even real in front of him. And so they have to look to other people to see like which fork do I use for this instance, right? So we don't know what to do. And so we copy and look to other people.
Those are very good examples.
Thank you. You weren't sure where I was going with that.
Is the rest of Shrek 2 based off of the Titanic?
No, I don't. No. Okay. I don't remember the rest of Shrek 2.
Okay.
I don't necessarily go to that movie often, or the Titanic for that matter. Sorry, Leonardo.
Yeah. And Kate. Okay, so social influences are not the only reason we conform. We also respond to outright commands from individuals. So like we talked about with Milgram's experiment and with conformity that there are, with the foot in the door phenomenon, mm-hmm. we talked about the Holocaust. This is really what Milgram and his studies were based off of because the trial of the Nazi officers were happening at the time that he started to look at it. So if we look at what has to be present for us to obey, it's an authority figure, an element of prestige. Victim or subject is depersonalized, and that was really the foot in the door in Germany was a huge depersonalization mm-hmm. and minimalization of an entire group of people. And then the other part is everyone else is going along with it and no one is defying orders. So you would be on your own if you're doing that, putting yourself out on a limb. So this helped to give us a different understanding of people that were involved in the Holocaust, or at least make us think of other perspectives.
Mm-hmm. And like psychological perspectives too, which is important because there has to be something going on inside of there for something right. like that to happen. So being influenced by others is common and normal, and sometimes it can be good. Well, usually it's good.
Yeah.
Now, with being influenced by others, there is a diffusion of responsibility, which is basically when people feel less of a responsibility to take the right action when other people are present. So for an example, I would say if... I don't know if Mr. Smilek, who's our department chair, if he said that he's just going to fail all of his students because they're so terrible, they all have attitudes, I'm just going to fail every single one. And he said, you should all do the same. And we fail all of our students, then I'm going to diffuse that responsibility to him. Like, he's the one who told me to do it. He's like, he's not my boss, but he's kind of like my authority figure. Like, I have to listen to him. So it's his fault if somebody complains to me. That was a really random example, and I apologize for throwing Mr. Smilek under the bus like that.
Quick apology to Mr. Smilek.
He would never do that.
No.
Out loud.
So, social facilitation. This is one of the positive things usually that comes from the presence of other people. This is with the idea that people do better on simple tasks and worse on complex tasks when other people are around. So this is like the Yerkes-Dodson law that we had from last unit. If you don't remember that, then don't use that as your reference point. Mm-hmm. If you do, awesome. But the level of arousal in this unit is coming from the presence of others. So the example that we had here was people at the gym, machines at the gym. If you go to the gym all the time, you understand the machines, and that's an easy task. If other people are watching you, you might add on a few more pounds, be like, yeah, I can lift all of this. And your performance is high. If you've never been to the gym and you're like nervous about, oh, I don't want to mess up in front of all these people, you might fall off the treadmill because you put it up too high. You're stressed. You're nervous. And it's a more difficult task for you.
Yeah, I agree. I like that example a lot. It's similar to the pool hall study example that's here, so I'm just gonna skip over that. And go over to social loafing, when people are in the presence of others and their individual performance can't be evaluated, there's a tendency to perform worse on simple or unimportant tasks, but better on complex or important tasks. Can you think of an example for this?
Yes. Busy work in a class.
Oh, that is a good example.
That you don't really like. Yeah. You're going to perform worse because you're like, this isn't, I don't really care.
It's not graded. Doesn't matter.
It's not graded. Or maybe my group's performance is graded, mm-hmm. but not my participation individually. Mm-hmm. Then you're not going to do well. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if the task is in a class that you love, and this project is going to help get you into college, mm-hmm. or
help get you a better grade.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a little bit, it's important. It's a little bit more complicated, and you're working in a group. You're all going to be able to put in more effort.
Yeah. That's a good example. So with de-individuation, try saying that 3 times fast, it's the loosening of normal constraints on behavior when people can't be identified, for example, like when they're in a crowd. This can lead to an unleashing of behaviors that we would never dream of like doing ourselves. So it's also known as a mob mentality. And this makes people less accountable. That's why they do it. Excuse me. And they recognize that there's a reduced likelihood that they can be singled out and blamed for their behavior because other people are doing it too. And so the result is that we don't always lead to aggressive or antisocial behavior. It depends on what the group norm is, but it doesn't require face-to-face contact, and the internet is like social media is the best example of this.
Yeah.
This is where we see cyberbullying, for mm-hmm. example, because you don't have face to face, or you can even like make your like a separate account that doesn't show that it's you, then you might contribute to like a bad behavior. Maybe everybody else is doing it, so you're gonna do it too. Yeah. So
there's less of a reflection on you.
Yeah.
You feel less accountable.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So our last topic for today, for day two, sorry, was groupthink. This is a kind of decision making in which maintaining group cohesiveness and solidarity is more important than considering the facts in a realistic manner. So to kind of put that out of a full definition, the idea of all of you being on the same page is more important than bringing in outside perspectives in groupthink. Most likely to occur when the group is already highly cohesive, so you're already very similar on the same page, isolated from contrary opinions. You have someone who actually is a leader and like giving directions when you're under stress, so like a decision has to be made quickly, where you have to have unanimity.
A unanimous vote.
That's better. Thank you. And if there are poor decision-making procedures, so if there's not an opportunity for everyone to like equally present their idea, even if only a few of these are in place, it can be worse.
And then group polarization, which is the tendency for groups to make decisions that are more extreme than the initial inclinations of their members. This leads to persuasive arguments interpretation and social comparison interpretation. Persuasive argument interpretation is when all individuals bring the group a set of arguments supporting their initial recommendation, and it might expose you to persuasive arguments you hadn't thought of before. Whereas social comparison interpretation is when people discuss an issue in a group that they first check out how everybody else feels. So an individual's support the group's values, and then they present themselves in a positive light by valuing it just a bit more.
So, social influence on social relationships. This is switching gears a bit, but we've got prejudice and stereotype here. These are words we've used before, terms that we've used, but the important thing here is that prejudice is an attitude towards a group and its members. Unjustifiable and incorrect, usually negative. Stereotype, on the other hand, is a generalized belief about a group of people that can lead to prejudice.
I really like this sentence in this blue box. I think it kind of summarizes both of these things really well. What you believe, which is a stereotype, influences how you feel, which is the prejudice. So the stereotype is that belief, the prejudice is that feeling or that attitude, and stereotypes can lead to a prejudice, right? So yep. I like Great. That sentence, that kind of summarizes it.
Aggression, any physical or verbal behavior intended to harm someone, whether it's done out of hostility or as a calculated means to an end. And as always, we've got our nature-nurture question of how does it emerge? Mm-hmm. The answer is biology and or experience. Yeah,
exactly. Now, if you haven't noticed, there's a lot of vocab in this whole unit, and we're going to go through day four with all of the vocab that's here as well. So that Quizlet study set or making your own is going to be really important because I feel like we've just gone through all vocab yep. all the time. So make sure that you understand the vocab. That's why we had that assignment, so you can learn more and like encode it better. But let's move on to the last bit here on day four, and let's start with conflict. In history class, we've been talking about World War II, which is why the Holocaust was there straight on my mind. But conflict is it's basically when two things are incompatible, right? Actions, goals, ideas, whatever. And this can happen between people or nations. It can be minor. It can be major. Major would be like World War II, right? Minor would be kids not being able to share a toy, right? So both things are conflicts, whether it's big or small.
Sometimes conflicts lead us into social traps, which is where individuals will pursue self-interest and become caught up in mutually destructive behavior because they're so focused on that self-interest. So oftentimes it's also when a group of people act to obtain short-term individual gains instead of things that benefit the group in the long run. And one of the examples that we went over for this is the prisoner's dilemma. Mm-hmm. So if both prisoners acted for the good of each other and not for individual short-term gain, and neither of them confess, they would each get 1 year. Mm-hmm. If both of them fully thought for themselves and just wanted to protect themselves, they both confessed, they'd both get 5 years. Mm-hmm. But the reason why they might try to or why they would both confess is because of that thinking for themselves, where they have the possibility of them getting 0 years and the other person getting 10. So here, and with you, most of our social traps, there's not necessarily a positive outcome. Mm-hmm. It's always going to be a trap. It's hard. It's mm-hmm. difficult to determine, but the moral of the story here is snitches get stitches. Oh. Just kidding. Kidding.
Another vocab kidding. You do not need.
But no, to think of the entire group in long-term goals as opposed to individual and short-term.
Yeah. Perception of the out-group. Love the World War II propaganda here. I did not add that. That was already so. Yeah. Like they just know whoever this is. They just know.
They.
So a perception of the out group is when we are in conflict with somebody and we perceive that other person unfavorably. So we tend to demonize each other. Both sides demonize each other. So you can think of if or when the United States was at war with Japan during World War II. We have tons of propaganda posters against the Japanese, right? Mm-hmm. That was really like making them like turn out like demonized, I think is the word. I'm just going to use it again, to make them look like they are like the worst people ever and like we should be against them. Now, I do not have any examples off the top of my head of the opposite of that propaganda from Japan against the United States. But because of the perception of the out-group, typically we would see that. If we view the out-group as evil and untrustworthy, and they view us the same way, where they're out-group, they're our in-group. This is the mirror image perception. And then this can lead to self-serving bias as well, which this is not the first time that we've seen self-serving bias. But basically with self-serving bias, like if we do it, it's good. I'm going to step away from the war thing because it's kind of morbid. But yep. If we, you know, say something bad about somebody to our friends and gossip, then it's fine because we did it. But if they do it about us, that's awful, right? Yeah. So that's self-serving bias.
Like you went full actress.
I did. I had like the Cali girl
going
for you. I
appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, so similar to what Mrs. Navidad was just talking about, the perception of the out-group is with the fundamental attribution error. So it's going to be when you're looking at the out-group, you'll give them a dispositional reason for why they're doing it. So like they're building up their military because they're aggressive and want to take us over. But when we look at ourselves, we're building up our military in order to defend ourselves. So we've got that conflict going on. And if we, this leads to the self-fulfilling prophecy because the perceptions confirm themselves. Mm-hmm. Because as we build up our military to defend ourselves, they'll build up their military to be aggressive or vice versa. And so just from these ideas at the beginning, if we continue to militarize ourselves, we'll eventually end up going to war.
Absolutely. And then with peacemaking and cooperation, there are two different, well, there's a goal and then there's a theory. There's the superordinate goal and then there's the realistic conflict theory. So the superordinate goal is a shared goal that overrides differences among people or groups of people. And they put aside differences to work towards that goal. And the goal has to be big enough and compelling enough for the groups to overlook the differences. We watched this video on the cave experiment, and that kind of showed us that these young boys would work together to, I forget exactly what they did, but they worked together basically to, as a group,
save the water tank.
Yeah, yeah, to like help out around the camp and be productive and survival almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then the realistic conflict theory, conflicts arise between groups because of conflicting goals and limited resources. So again, going back to these boys, they were pinned up against each other at first. It was a competitive atmosphere. And so because of the realistic conflict theory, they were in conflict with each other. But after they had a compelling enough goal to work together, they started working together. And we can see that through the superordinate goal.
Yes. Yeah. All right. And altruism. This is the unselfish regard for others. This is intrinsic. Did you in your class look in the heart?
Yeah, I see compassion, principle.
Florida.
Latin.
Gets a little weird after compassion. I'm not sure.
Google didn't do us well.
Not super well. So yeah, don't pay attention, but to the heart. But basically, the main thing that you need to know from altruism is the bystander effect. John Darley and Bib Latane? Latane?
Latiny? I don't know.
Latiny?
You're asking me?
I don't know. studied the bystander effect and found that the more people there are, the less likely each person is to give aid or help. We looked at the Kitty Genovese case in class. Granted, that was disproven, but still important. And this is the idea of like, oh, I thought someone else was going to help. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Okay, so going back to the Kitty Genovese case, like you said, it was disproven. But I don't actually know where you were going with that. I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
I can't like pick up where we left off. We know I can't do that well.
Well, you also tried to pick. You picked up where I left off, which was an interesting choice. But I appreciated it.
Yeah, I tried.
So that was disproven, but that encouraged people like John Darley and Buddy Bibb Latane to look into the bystander effect. What I talked about here, did you know that everyone here gets CPR certified?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, when I was being CPR certified at like 10 and not actually.
I did it first with when I started babysitting. So I went to like a babysitting class and then they taught us and we got CPR certified.
Yeah, I learned at summer camp. But one of the things they told us that always stuck with me is if you are with a group of people, don't just say call 911. You need to point to one person and say, you go call 911.
They're not going to do it.
Or no one's going to do it because it's kind of a, oh, they'll take care of Someone else will take it.
Yeah, there was an incident. I won't go into too many details, but there was an incident at school a while ago. And some kid had an accident. And the kids around him who witnessed it, they were staring at him. And instead of doing anything about it, we ended up finding out it was fine. But we were like, why didn't you do anything? They were like, well, we thought he was going to do something. You know, like all pointing the finger at each other. Not to like, you know, oh, I thought throwing them under the bus, I thought he was going to do it. It was more like there were other people. Like,
yeah.
I was just here. So, yeah, it's very real.
Yeah. So the decision-making process and the bystander intervention, so how we can stop this, there are three steps. First is that you have to notice the incident. This is related to signal detection theory, which we talked about way back in Unit 3. You need to notice that something's going on. Then you need to interpret that incident as an emergency. So you need to see that guy sitting on the stairway, not as someone just catching their breath, but as someone who's collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And the final thing, probably one of the most important steps, is to assume responsibility. So don't feel that, oh, I thought he was going to take care of it, or that diffusion of responsibility. It is your responsibility to do something. Mm-hmm. And that's how we can combat the bystander effect.
Yeah. And then, whew, helping or socialization. So the social exchange theory, this can be known as cost-benefit analysis. So all of our econ students, we know about this. Cost-benefit, it's like pros and cons. Benefit is the pro, cost is the con. So you really have to weigh, like, you want more good things, more pros than you do cons, bad. So you're going to make sure that there's more pros and benefits than there are costs. So I'll do it if I get something out of it. My students really liked Bob as an example.
My students felt that Bob was not worth the cost. Bob was a very high cost.
I mean, I feel like Bob is a little, I don't know the nicest word I can use, so I'm going to not say it. There is a nicer word. I can't think of it, so I'm just not going to say it. Bob, he's obnoxious. Oh, I'm sorry, not Bob. I'm sorry. If you're nice to Bob, you're not being... Okay, never mind. I feel bad for Bob. It doesn't matter. I was reading it.
But Bob is obnoxious.
Yeah.
And loud, and he smells.
But if you're nice to him, you might get to go out with your sister. That doesn't make you a princess either, right?
You might get to go out with his sister.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. I just don't think that's the way to Louise's heart.
I don't either. Yeah.
Are we in agreement, but talking as if we're not?
I think because I started out, I don't know. Can you?
You
can take it. Okay. Sorry.
So the benefits and the cost can be physical or psychological. So you could think like, okay, the benefit from this is that I feel good about myself, or like I know that I did a good thing. But if it's going to cost you like 10 days of feeling weak and tired and exhausted because it's helping your friend move or doing something, which everyone should totally do, Is it super nice to help friends move?
I told you I would help you move.
I just realized I shouldn't have used that as an example because I said that the cost would outweigh the benefit. I really need help.
I've already committed.
Anyway, yeah, it can just be physical or psychological. The reciprocity norm, expectation that we should return help, not harm, to those who have helped us. So when Mrs. Navidad helps me to move in, mm-hmm. instead of turning around and saying, okay, fine, you're never allowed here anymore, or just being rude, I would, you know, do something nice.
The way that I see it is that when I help you move, you're going to help me move.
Perfect.
Okay, perfect. You heard it here first.
Yes.
And then the social responsibility norm is the expectation that we should help those who need our help. So like young children, I think of elderly too.
I definitely think of elderly too.
Even if the costs outweigh the benefit.
Yeah.
Oh wow, are we done?
We're done.
Oh, wow.
Finally. Woo. We're done, but you're not in your review because you should definitely look over that attraction readings. There are some terms in here. There are separate set of notes for the with guided questions. Highly recommend that you look at that to see what is important. And at the very least, look at the bolded terms in the attraction reading. Mm-hmm.
Flashcards, you guys. I'm telling you.
Huge.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're done here.
We're done here. Happy studying.
I was just going to say the same thing. Oh my goodness.
Is that our new
okay,
exit?
Let's do it. 3, 2, 1. Happy studying.
Oh, oh yes.
You guys are gonna hate us.
Okay, see you later. I can't find my cursor.
It's the other way.